constantly quoting movies that no one ever saw. It's Carpenter and Rothman.
All right, welcome back in. Carpenter and Rothman, Anthony Rothman, Bobby Carpenter, and we go to the Bryant Heating and Cooling Systems Fan Guest Hotline. And welcome on a woman that has covered literally every major sporting event, but more importantly for this conversation, was right there in the thick of it in the 90s covering Michael Jordan and those Bulls for the Chicago Tribune as their principal beat writer. She is Melissa Isaacson. Melissa, great to have you. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. All I'm doing is soaping down my grapes right now, so I'm not. That sounded terrible, but I just I was rushing to rinse my produce before you called. So you know,
hey,
I've got really important things. Yeah,
that's a priority this time when everyone's trying to lock in and stay safe. So I'm sure you were locked in last night watching the Last Dance. So all right, so for our listeners and listen, me being a Chicago native as well, and I was in Rockford at the time, so we were coming in covering all the parades and all that. But were you there for the entire dynasty with the Tribune, or was that just early 90s? Give me kind of a history on
you. Yeah. The first championship, I was a sidebar person. And then I took over the beat in 90, 91 and covered the next, you know, the rest of the three-peat, the first three-peat. Wrote a book about the year in between Michael's first retirement called Transition Game when they were trying to adjust, obviously, without him, and he was adjusting to baseball. And then had my first kid and then went to the Bears, but still in the off seasons of the Bears in those days, there were off seasons of things, would come back and cover the Bulls. So I was around the Bulls during their entire three-peat with the exception of the final last couple of playoffs I was giving birth, or else I would have been there. But I just blamed my son last night. He's like, "Were you at that Seattle?" I'm like, "No, it's your fault. I wasn't there." But it feels like I've had like seven kids because I'm always referring to them to being pregnant, but only two. But yeah.
That's good. All right. So let me start it out with this. What did they leave out last night in your estimation? And maybe what did you know that maybe you would have liked to have seen in there with this relationship right now with Krause, the players, the end of Phil Jackson, and Jerry Reinsdorf kind of just being an overseer to his own team almost?
I found it really interesting that people, even people who were around, you know, other reporter friends were like, wow, they're really rough on Reinsdorf and Krause. Like, they didn't come off looking good. And maybe because I was around them so much, I thought Jerry Reinsdorf, among all his qualities, you know, and he was often portrayed as ruthless, was also had a lot of integrity about him, still does. And so when he told Scotty and Michael, but Scotty in particular, this is not a good contract, he was being absolutely honest. I remember it like yesterday, and Scotty said, no, I need the money up front to support my family, to help support my family. He didn't talk about it a great deal publicly, but that was why he needed it front loaded. And Jerry was afraid that he would, and he said, look, this is a deal. This is it. And he was afraid of just what would happen, that Scotty would become, you know, furious about it and resentful eventually. And so if Jerry Reinsdorf came up looking bad, I thought maybe more attention could have been paid with that. That he warned him, but I think they did. Mm-hmm. As far as Krause, you know, I had friends who texted me last night and they were like, is he really that bad? And I know it's terrible because they're like, you know, that's not fair because he's not around to defend himself. And I mean, I hope his wife isn't listening because, you know, he's a father. And to those who loved him, he was a good man. And I know there were people who liked him. But he wasn't easy to work with. He was not someone that the media, I don't want to paint us all with the same brush. I did not have a good experience with him. I did not like him. I thought he was very unfair and crude, and everything they, you know, was it nice of Michael to make fun of him being fat or whatever, or like Pippen, you know, make mooing sounds when he walked on the bus, but they didn't go into details about how mean they were on the bus. The bus was brutal. Like, I'd walk down, like, you know, the streets of New York in a bikini before I'd get on the bus as Jerry Krause on the Bulls bus. But why was he on the bus? You know, like, get off the damn bus. Like, he didn't have to ride the bus with them. So part of it was he was so annoying. So I think there was a lot of stuff they could have told, but, you know, they had 2 hours in the first two episodes. You know, he used to, he was incredibly paranoid. You know, they called him Sleuth, among other things. Crumbs was another one. But he always was sure that everybody's spying on him. So Phil would tease him. Like, while the others would be mean, Phil would just get under his skin. And so Phil had a summer home in Montana on the lake, and he had a party line. I don't know if any of your viewers or listeners, rather, remember, you know, party lines where, you know, there are more than one people on the line. It sounds so weird now, but, you know, there's more than one family, more than one house on the line. And Phil had enough money at that point. He certainly could have gotten a private phone line, but it was just, you know, the lake, and that's what everybody had. And he knew it drove Jerry crazy because he thought, like, Ethel from across the lake was going to hear some big secret about Tony Kukoc, and, like, you know, he would go nuts every time he'd call. He'd swear up and down and tell Phil, like, oh, get rid of this damn party line, you know. And Phil just cracked up because he knew it drove him crazy, and he knew Jerry wouldn't call him and wouldn't want to talk because the secrets would leak out. So much of it, like, Jerry couldn't help himself but brought it on himself. So, you know, no, I thought, like, if anything, they were probably nice. I really did.
Wow, that's amazing. It's Melissa, and we're sitting here. You mentioned the party lines. My dad would always bring that up because they had them growing up. But, I mean, this was something in, like, the 80s and 90s that's happening, which is crazy. But I guess it's Montana, so it's obviously
it's 90s,
it's a little different maybe out there in a remote area like that. You know, this is something that Anthony and I were talking about because, you know, you look at Krause, like, he essentially, you know, found Phil. He promoted him to head coach, and so he essentially kicked his career off. And so at some point that the relationship had to be, you know, pretty cordial and amicable. And then it began to pivot. Like, do you know of what the inflection point was that made it shift? I know there's probably a lot of small things that moved in one direction, but I feel like for something to erode that significantly, there has to be one defining moment in a relationship when you're having that much success that would sour to that point.
I think the thing that Jerry did, I'm not even sure he knew he was doing it, Krause, that is that he liked to take ownership of people. So he hired Phil when Phil walked into the interview with a hat with a feather coming out of it, you know, some long, weird feather, and he was wearing, like, some crazy outfit. I can't even remember, some fur thing or something. You know, he just was a free spirit. And so Jerry, you know, the hippie Phil, and, you know, it was a big joke that he rescued him. No one wanted him. And, you know, meanwhile, he was a pretty good player on a world championship Knicks team. He wasn't exactly a nobody. And he was an assistant with the Bulls. So, you know, he'd already proven that he could hold a job. And so, you know, Jerry liked to act like he just scraped him off the, you know, scrap heap. And, you know, it was funny for a while. And I think Phil tired of that, you know, that he always was like, I discovered this guy. I discovered Pippen. He wouldn't have been anything if I hadn't found him. And, you know, Michael resented him because for the same kind of theme that developed, that he had sort of an ownership over him, you know, that he wanted to make sure after he broke his foot that it was in his contract that he not do anything. You know, he not play basketball, pickup, he not go skiing, he not. There was, I think, one of the original contracts like that. And maybe it was really wise of Jerry, you know, because really, do you want Michael Jordan skiing? You know, I don't, probably not. And maybe somebody should have had in Jay Williams' contract, he shouldn't have been on a motorcycle. So, you know, I mean, that's probably pretty smart. But at the time, Michael started feeling like he was owned by Jerry, and he really, really resented that. And so I think that was it. And Jerry just had, you know, as much as he tried to be one of the guys, he just wasn't. And even if you have that personality to be one of the guys, you're not as the GM, you're the boss. And so, you know, by getting on the bus and stuff like that, and they'd go into, I mean, I'll gross out your listeners, but so there'll be an imagery here situation. But, you know, they'd go into the locker room routinely, and he would be, you know, half or fully naked on the massage table getting a massage. And did he really have to do, like, was that necessary? You know what I mean? And the players, does anybody want to be compared to a world championship athlete, you know, world caliber athlete? Like, just, you know, it was gross. And so they made fun of him. And, like, you're asking for it, in that setting. It's like a frat house setting anyway. So that's the kind of stuff he did that really invited. Believe me, was not there to witness, just going on secondhand. But I trust my eyewitnesses. I trust my sources on that one.
These stories are fantastic. Yeah. Talking with the award-winning journalist, Melissa Isaacson, from the Chicago Tribune, who covered those championship with the Bulls. I'm going to ask you something unprecedented. Can you wash your produce for about 3-4 minutes and join us for our next segment if we take a break?
I would be pleased to continue to rinse my produce. Yeah,
yes.
Thank you.
All right, do that, because we have many more questions, because your stories have been the best I've heard, and that's including in all of the buildup of ESPN with the documentary The Last Dance. Back with more with Melissa Isaacson after this. Carpenter and Rothman on The Fan.
Happy birthday to us. Proud to be your Heritage Sports Talker for 25 years, and we couldn't do it without you. Now let's hug. The Fan, Ohio sports destination.
All right, back at it. And what a nice thing to have today, a firsthand breakdown from someone that saw it firsthand, Melissa Isaacson, the award-winning journalist and the principal beat writer for the Michael Jordan-led Chicago Bulls during the championship years of the early 90s. And then she covered everything, obviously, in Chicago and every major sporting event you can imagine. So Melissa's still with us on the Bryant Heating Cooling Systems Fangest Hotline. Let me bring you back to Pippen, Melissa, because I think that was last night. I'm glad that people got a glimpse into the kind of guy Scottie was and the kind of player he was, because I think it was very easy to say it was Michael and the Jordanaires, but I'm glad people saw Pippen at his best last night. But the question I wanted to ask you is this. So he gets the ruptured tendon. He waited to have his ankle done, and not at the start of the offseason. Even Michael thought that was wrong last night, and that was bad to do. But let me take you to the end. He was traveling with them, but he was still rehabbing. You're going to lose him anyway. Ownership, I guess, killed the Pippen trade, or he was upset he was willing to be traded. Why, if Jerry Reinsdorf, why didn't he reward him at least then for the success that he gave him? Like, I understand why he didn't want him walking back in his office in a year or two regretting the contract he signed. But towards the end, when he's making 2.8, why wouldn't he then say, I at least have to give him a reward contract? And he had basketball left.
Agree. And I think, I think Scottie obviously is smart enough to understand that, look, I signed it, I got to live with it. But toward the end, when they're like, we're going to trade you, and, Scottie was a great team player. And I know, he probably doesn't come off that way with certain moments that he's had during his career, and that was certainly one of them. And he had, I don't want to say thin skin is kind of the wrong way to describe him, but his teammates loved him. His teammates absolutely loved him and did not resent him for some of the things he did. Yeah, for sure at the moment, Michael's mad at him. But are they still close today? Did they still, they ended up winning, so winning, soothes all. But I think that's where Reinsdorf lost fans. I think that's where he got the boos, scattered boos, maybe more than scattered, in the ceremonies, the trophy ceremonies. Kraus got booed every time, and I used to actually feel bad for him, but they both did. And I think that's where it happened. I think people were like, come on, really? I mean, at least that's the way I remember it. And I think that's how Scottie looked at it. Scottie always felt like he was second banana, so to speak, and he was. And so that was a moment where they could have been, where Jerry could have done that. But I think he just felt like he didn't want to set a precedent. Michael was also vastly underpaid throughout his career. It's just the way things broke. He had good representation, but, it's just the way the contracts kind of stacked up that he was never paid really what he was worth. And I think everyone, Jerry included, felt like, and maybe even Michael, his Nike contract was so immense that, it's fine, whatever. So I think maybe Jerry felt like, well, if I reward Scottie, then I got to go back and fix Michael and that sort of thing. I'm not sure exactly. Sam Smith really, really did a lot of the contract stories, and I was certainly involved and did some, but that's how I recall, that's how I remember it, that people were a little annoyed by that, and that Scottie didn't have the fans turn on him at that point like he could have.
Talking to Melissa Isaacson, cover the Chicago Bulls in the 90s and now is also on the staff at the Northwestern and the esteemed and prestigious Medill School of Journalism up there. And, you know, there was a phrase that was thrown out there, Melissa, that, you know, Rothman brought up, and we started, and he said he'd never really, you know, heard it. I mean, maybe to the extent, but, you know, the culture of the Bulls when Michael Jordan got there obviously wasn't the best. They weren't drawing hardly anybody, and you can see it in the stands, and they're showing some of the clips from when he played. They threw out the cocaine circus. Like, how bad were things with this Bulls team when he arrived?
I think that was pretty standard, you know, procedure around the league and around baseball. And, you know, I mean, baseball players are popping greenies, and NBA players had cocaine in their midst. And so I think that was somewhat of the culture, and they didn't have, you know, the drug testing and stuff that we do now. And so, yeah, I think absolutely. It was like, I didn't cover those teams in the 80s, but I think it was a very well-kept secret that cocaine was very prevalent. And Michael was honest when he was portraying himself as kind of a country, I don't want to say bumpkin, but, you know, an innocent country boy kind of guy, you know, coming from North Carolina. And then, you know, even the university couple years, he's still very, very young when he gets to Chicago. So when he walked into that hotel room and described things he had never seen before and kind of tried to stay away from it, I think that's absolutely what he did. And I think that his coming to Chicago sort of signaled the end of that era. You know, I mean, there are players that were reputed to be doing that stuff. And I think coaches knew, and I think it just happened. You know, I think it's just the way it was. It's crazy now to think about.
She's Melissa Isaacson, the Chicago Tribune back in the day, the principal beat writer covering the Jordan championships. We're up against the clock, but I want to tell people that not only did you cover basketball, but you were a championship player yourself in high school. And I wanted to give you a minute to tell us about your book, State, the team, the triumph, the transformation in the late 70s, you know, certainly before Title IX and all that. And the book looks fantastic.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, one of the honors writing that is that Steve Kerr graced, you know, it graces the cover with a blurb talking about the story he and I used to talk about. It's one teeny tiny thing, as weird as it is, but I think people could relate to this. If you've played a certain sport, if you've won at a certain level, even if it's a high school, you feel like you suddenly have something in common. So I talked to the guys, you know, as much as they let me about playing basketball. It was kind of fun, and it still remains sort of my claim to fame. I was on one of the first state championships for girls in Illinois. We were really behind after Title IX. It was the late 70s, and it was one of the first ones. We beat Jackie Joyner's team in the state final. But the book is really a coming-of-age story of this first generation of Title IX girls and how our lives were just completely altered by this experience. How my favorite part of the book is the epilogue and what happened to us in the process and how, you know, what we are doing today is a direct result of what happened then and all the many, many things that were swirling around us in high school that we had no idea were going on. Because in those days, you know, your parents would say, you know, the neighbors are getting divorced. You know, they'd whisper because it was like a secret. You know, no social media. Nobody talked about that stuff. So behind closed doors, there was alcoholism and you know, domestic abuse and death even in the family that we didn't know about our teammates and our coaches. And what basketball gave us during a time when girls were not given access to the kind of lessons you learn in sports just absolutely shifted our entire lives. So that's my story. It was, you know, it was 15 years in the making. I wrote another book in between, and I started it, you know, I thought about it while I was covering the Bulls and the Bears, and I went to ESPN. And so it's really personal, and I'm really, you know, happy with it. And it's, thank you for letting me talk about it. It came out not that long ago.
Yeah, congratulations on it. We'll have people look it up. State, a team, a triumph, a transformation, by Melissa Isaacson. Melissa, you have done more for us than we could have hoped. And who knows? I guarantee we'll be reaching out to you again as the series unfolds over the next month. So thank you so much. Take care and be well.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime. Thank you, and you guys be well as well.
Thanks. Melissa Isaacson, who covered Jordan and those Bulls in the championship years. When we come back, SportsCenter update, and then more. Carpenter and Rothman on the Fan.
A quarter century of sports conversation and play-by-play. And let's not forget the fart jokes. Thanks for nothing, common man. The Fan, Ohio sports destination.